morning, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. Forgot my headphones. Darn it.
What the heck? You're supposed to be ready to go. Be a professional, please.
Well, okay, so I'm going to have to wing the music. I forgot my headphones. So, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Dr. Farrell in Palisades.
Oh,
and we have a commercial.
Then there's Dr. Farrell.
There's Dr. Farrell.
Annual membership.
You get some free airtime there. There we go. Hey, our real sponsor today is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Yeah. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they deal in everything John Deere Ag and Turf. So if you need mowers, tractors, implements, you need service for your tractors or parts, go by and see them. They do it all. And don't forget, generator season is coming up. They've got a full line of Honda generators ready to go. And steel products. Get a big windstorm, branches fall down, go buy a chainsaw. They've got them in stock.
And it's not really generator season. It's PG&E is shutting your power off season.
That's right. Get ready to thaw your turkey because it's coming. So anyway, their phone number is 226-9226. And get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Terrific. Yeah. Okay, so today is Father's Day. Happy Father's Day.
Oh, thank you.
All the dads out there and all the stepdads, because they wind up being the dads too. It's June 21st, 2020, in case we air this later, which I'm sure we will because it's about history. So I think really the emphasis on history is incredibly important now.
Get it while you can, because it's going away.
We're
going to reset the calendar here pretty quick.
God. I just wanted to let people know you can find everything about the show along with archives that are no charge to listen to, and they are commercial free at wethepeopleradio.us. So it has to be We the People Radio. Also include the word radio.us, because We the People, something else is used. So anyway, We the
People. And .us, not .com.
Everything but .com, actually. .net, .biz, .info. You can pick any of those. I own all those.
Not .com.
Some knucklehead has .com and is doing nothing with it. So, anyway, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us and you get nothing, you typed it in wrong. We had a little snag with that a little earlier. We've got some updates from South Africa coming in upcoming weeks. We have updates on China. What's really going on over there. So we'll have our Chinese dissident friends will come on and tell us all about that. And those things are all marked at the top of the page. They have tabs for you so you can get to those programs easily, because it takes a long time to scroll through 10 years of archives.
Yeah.
I don't mean to put everyone through the paces. So you can just go to those tabs at the top and cheat. So our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. We have he's like our all-around, knows everything about everything. He's like, I don't know. Who is he? He's like the Ace is the Place with the Helpful Hardware Man. we need to make him like his own slogan. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He's served on the Congressional EMP Commission, Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, that we talk about a lot on this show, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, and the House Armed Services Committee. Dr. Pry was an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, which is why he knows so much about that, and we pick his brain often. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another PhD in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. He's the author of numerous books, and his most recent one is The Power and the Light, The Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. So the books are actually all listed on the webpage if you go there today. I've got links to all of them and descriptions about all of them, and so we've made fairly short work of your research there. I can't think of anything else. We're talking about history today, so we're going to delve into Dr. Pry's real passion, because every time we talk to him, Cicero comes up. So I always chuckle. I'm like, we should do a show just about the history, and with all this I don't know what you call it, revolution, I guess, and craziness out there. This isn't the first time in history this has happened, as I think everyone is aware, but I'm not sure people really realize the detail.
So, I think it's the first time it's happened in our country where there's been a concerted effort to eliminate our history and rewrite it.
Okay, Bill put all his chips in on that one, so we're going to find out. We're going to find out if he's right or not. So, Dr. Pryor, are you in there?
Yes.
Terrific.
I'm sorry if I was a little late picking up.
That's okay. We're a little late calling you.
They had a Father's Day party for me today.
Nice.
And my birthday was yesterday. So it's sort of a back-to-back celebrations here. And,
Well, happy Father's Day birthday to you.
Well, thank you. history. Well, that's, I used to teach it. I taught at three different colleges and universities when I was young. And it's just to every historian, well, maybe not to every historian, to those who were trained in the classical tradition of history, which probably stopped in the 70s and 80s in this country, maybe in the 80s, when I was going to graduate school. It's heartbreaking. But modern history programs and social science programs, except for, in some, with rare exception, I think, have become radicalized, you know, which is why we have so many of our supposedly educated young people who've really been brainwashed and radicalized themselves into the, you know, Marxist, racist, you know, view of things. But to see them tearing down monuments and so ignorantly understanding, you know, where our society stands in the ranks of former civilizations, you know, the notion that America is evil and that we're an institutionally racist society, when in fact we are the most egalitarian, freest, most prosperous, most opportunity society for all races and ethnic groups that has ever existed. And that is simply a historical fact, and a fact that anyone with common sense can obviously discover, because ethnic groups from all over the world, people of all races and creeds, want to come here, and we even have to build a wall to keep them out. They don't come here just legally, but they want to come here illegally. Why would they do that if they didn't think it was in their interests, and if it was if we were really like Nazi Germany or something like that?
If we were the fascists that they say we are.
Yeah, they wouldn't be breaking down the doors to get in.
Said the people with the guns making a fake town in Seattle, yeah.
Right. The people aren't beating down the doors to get into China or to get into North Korea or to get into Russia or into any of these socialist societies. And nor can you find any other country outside of Africa that has elected a black to be their president and done so twice. No, I think Barack Obama was the worst president in our history. I'm not particularly proud of him as a president, okay? But I am proud that we have a civilization that's capable of looking past race,
right,
you know, to elect someone to be president. And he kind of got elected on false grounds, because at least his first election was based on his rhetoric was very post-racial. And, but that... Let's get more into, and before I depart our current circumstances and we go backwards in time, I can't resist making one more point. You know, I was toying, when I was thinking about this show that we were going to talk about and the events going on in the country, and how we're supposed to be such a racist society and everything. I remember, because I think of when I was in graduate school, back in the early 80s, that's when the turn came. That's when, you know, you still had some conservative professors left who understood, you know, the classical historical tradition, but the university was clearly being taken over by the left. I remember, back in the early 80s, that as a graduate student, if you were a conservative, you know, the conservative professors were cowed and hiding under their desks, basically, and afraid to speak up. And the left wing was the leftists and the radical feminists and the like were all out there, very bold and as brass, so getting away with murder so that they would, for example, if you were a conservative, they would they would take away your on a scholarship. They would try to take away your scholarship, okay, to make sure only left-wing people had those. And tried to do it to me, as a matter of fact, at one time. But didn't succeed, fortunately. That's another story. But one of the books that was required reading, if you were studying history or social science, and maybe it probably still required reading in these universities, was a book called Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. And Eldridge Cleaver was a 60s Black Panther, black nationalist, you know, deeply racist because he hated whitey. His book is, he was a communist. You know, his book was just as rabid, even perhaps more so even, than the attitudes that you find among Black Lives Matters and Antifa. You know, he felt it was, in his book, he describes it being perfectly justifiable to rob and white people and rape white women. You know, they have it coming to them. There's no bad thing that the black race could do to the white race because of all the sins of the white race. And at some point along the line of the Black Panthers, he got involved in a crime. Don't remember if it was a murder of a policeman or a robbery or something like that to support their radical activities, but it forced him into exile. He fled the country to, and gladly, by the way, to go to the Soviet Union and Communist China, various totalitarian systems where he lived for a number of years, serving as a mouthpiece for them, you know, denouncing the United States and the West, and discovered what those places were really like, and became so shocked, so appalled, and himself, because they, of course, ended up in those societies nobody is trusted, and he found himself under more scrutiny and oppression than anything he imagined possible.
Imagine that.
Imagine that.
And he actually redefected to the United States. He escaped to the U.S. Embassy, even willing to face prison if necessary.
To get out?
Yeah, to escape socialism, communism, to escape the workers' paradise. And we took him back.
Hold that thought. We'll do a cliffhanger there. Got to take a really quick break. Speaking of capitalism, that means we have to communism. We have to take a capitalism break. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. You all body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. What shall we do about them?
Yes, because it's against the law, and out here, you must wear a mask, unless you don't want to, in which case, what are they going to do? Hold you down and strap it to your face? I'm going to find out what they do at the airport on Thursday. I'll let you know when I get back how that worked out for me.
Yeah, you better keep one in your back pocket.
Yeah.
You can only press it so hard.
I wonder if a Post-it note would work. I could just hook it on my nose, be hanging down. That's like a face covering, right?
I'd go with the Batman mask.
They all say face covering. Saw a guy yesterday in church. It went like all the way down to his shirt. So I'm not sure what kind of pollution comes out of your neck, but apparently apparently he was saving us from his neck pollution. But I digress. Sorry. Okay, go back to Dr. Pry. Sorry about that.
Not at all.
We should never
you
take breaks.
You are always so funny.
Makes me squirrely.
I'd rather listen to you than listen to me. maybe you should spend 2 hours just
talking about nothing,
comedy or something. Anyway, going back to Eldridge Cleaver, we were talking about the 1960s, 70s, Black Panther, communist, black nationalist. you know, one of the things he believed too was, you know, he wanted to. His dream was to have the blacks take over the old Confederacy. The states of the United States had been the old Confederacy, and break off from the mainland, from the United States, and that would become a black-dominated independent nation. Because, you know, he didn't think blacks and whites could live together either. But as I said, he escaped, quote unquote, from our country to the socialist paradise of, you know, the Soviet Union and their other totalitarian, authoritarian socialist Cuba. Lived there for many years and discovered that they were really nightmarish societies, far worse than anything he imagined. And he, not the paradises that he believed in. In fact, and they were also themselves deeply. Far real, he encountered real racism and real oppression there, living in 1984 type societies, and you know, redefected to the United States, escaped to the U.S. Embassy. I don't even think he had to serve any prison time, but we took him back. He literally kissed the ground when he. When the plane came back to the United States, got off on the tarmac and kissed the ground when he arrived. He became a Christian and a conservative Republican and ran for Congress, and unfortunately wasn't elected. The new Eldridge Cleaver, I would have voted for him. And I say that because he wrote another book that they never tell you about in graduate school called Soul on Fire, which I remember I had read that book when I was in graduate school, and we were compelled to read Soul on Ice. And the professor didn't even know about Soul on Fire. You know, the only book they care about, and the one that they foist upon their students, is the one critical of the United States that represents us as a institutionally racist, evil country, Cleaver's first book. They don't write his conversion book, the one that he wrote when he was older and wiser. And had actually lived in these countries, and changed his mind, changed his soul, and became a Christian and a conservative. Soul on Fire. And that book should be required reading for Black Lives Matters and Antifa and of all of our modern, you know, students. But that wasn't taught when I went to school, and it's probably... They probably still have it, you know, deeply, deeply buried and ignored it because, of course, it doesn't support the left-wing narrative. And I guess it's consistent with what G.K. Chesterton once said of socialism, you know, which is anybody who is not a socialist in their 20s has no heart, but anyone who is still a socialist in their 30s has no brain. Now, I guess to transition to talking about history, and although that is a form of history, since we are talking about matters that happened 30, 40 years ago with Eldridge Cleaver and the rest. But if we go back to, we were going to talk about political violence in history and in democracies, and this is one of the, in ancient Athens was a, riven with political violence, which is one of the reasons the founders didn't like democracy, something a lot of Americans don't understand. We often describe our system of government as a democracy, but it isn't. You know, a democracy is a condition where the people vote on everything. You know, you don't have representative government, you know, where you have representatives that you have voted for who then vote on laws and the like. It was direct representation by the people themselves. And that sounds appealing to a lot of people today. That's why they want to get rid of the Electoral College, you know, and have the president elected, you know, by a direct vote and all that. But the founders hated democracy. They thought it was a great evil because of the history of Athens, and they were right. You know, democracies, Athens as a democracy lasted less than a century. You know, it's very subject to demagoguery. It's very hard to stay the course. You know, as soon as the public starts feeling pain from some policy, a demagogue will come up who has who is an enemy of the existing elite who's running the thing and appeal to the people, you know, to overthrow the existing system and put in a new system and take a completely new direction. And if you look at the, and this was especially true of Athens, and the thing that became fatal to them was this failing of democracy during the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. He had been an Athenian general, and he himself was deeply critical of the problems with trying to fight a war against the Spartans under conditions of democracy. You know, because the strategies would zigzag, they couldn't stay the course, generals would be exiled or even executed, you know, if they became unpopular or failed in one campaign. And these failings eventually doomed Athens in the war with Sparta, which was not a democracy, and so they went down in defeat. So our system of government, the founders were great students of classical history, and you know, Athens was one of the polar stars that they looked to for the kinds of mistakes that were made in the past that we try to avoid in our system. That's why we're not really a democracy. We're a republic. You know, in a republic, you know, the difference is that the people vote for representatives who then go in and debate and pass laws on the behalf of the people. And the representatives are supposed to be elected, you know, based on the fact that they are successful, you know, that they are usually more experienced than the average person, presumably, you know, better schooled in law and politics and history and wisdom. And they are supposed to be leaders that people look up to. And that doesn't sound like I'm describing our Congress, does it? you know, so unfortunately, maybe that's one of our failings. But that's what we started off with. That's what the founders believed. And if you look at past Congresses, you know, the Congresses of not in the modern era, you know, there does seem to be quite a difference between the kinds of people who were elected to the Senate and the House of Representatives back in the good old days, you know, who did fit that kind of definition.
And a different...
Men of accomplishment, men of education, honest people who are not corrupt. Usually, that's one of the reasons, in fact, that it's gone away now, but in our early Constitution, you had to be a man of property. You had to have property, or you had to be relatively wealthy. That's considered a great evil in the era of populism, you know, that you would have be accomplished in that way. But they saw it as a safeguard against corruption, because if you were already rich, that proved that you were successful at something in life, and it would also help insulate you against being subject to bribery.
Yeah, exactly.
And now you're just bad. Now you got to get rid of you. We have to take another really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we have him as a hostage here on Father's Day for 2 full hours. Thank you so much. You can find everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc, Roy Khan, Juan Perón, Tuscanini, Dacron, Din, Din, Foo Falls, Rock Around the Clock.
Billy Joel should get big props for that.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah, that's like just a little piece of it. See, he rattles all that off, and you can actually understand him. He's obviously old, because now everybody sounds like... They all sound like they have masks on. Maybe that's why they like the masks.
Yeah.
Because those old people are like, can you just enunciate, please?
Take that damn mask off.
Never fails. All right. Sorry. Back to you, Dr. Brock.
You guys have a real genius for choosing songs for the subject matter that we're discussing.
Thank you.
I wonder how many people out there in BLM or in Antifa actually know who Albert Einstein is, but
asking a lot.
We had left off with why the founders had wanted, had a property test or a wealth test that they expected members of the Congress and the Senate to be men of wealth or property as a safeguard against corruption, and also as to provide some insurance that the people who would serve in those roles were successful at something and therefore, you know, might be competent. But there was another important reason for that. Because if you were successful, if you had a private enterprise, you were a successful merchant or had a big plantation or something of that sort, and that's where your wealth was, and that's what your chief goal in your private life was about, then your service in the Senate or the Congress was more likely to be genuinely a matter of public service, because it was going to cost you, you know, to leave your business and to come and serve in Congress. And it would also help be a safeguard against the possibility of the development of a perpetual aristocracy like we have today, you know, where a person becomes a member of the Congress or a member of the Senate, and they make a career of it and stay there forever. You know, throughout most of our history, it wasn't that way. You know, people wanted, out of a sense of public service, to be a congressman or a senator for a short while and then return to their private life, which is where their real success was. That was the theory, and it worked for a long time. Now, the second big example, you know, of our founders looked to for an example of a free system, you know, governed by consent of the people, you know, was, of course, the Roman Republic. You know, after the fall of Athens, centuries after the fall of Athens and the Peloponnesian War, the next one, you know, is the Roman Republic. You know, that lasted almost until the birth of Christ, you know, for a period of about 500 years, and so it was quite successful, but it wasn't a democracy. This was a Republican form of government, and you know, so that you had a Senate that comprised the wealthier part of the and the more successful part, people who had military backgrounds as well, people who were greatly accomplished, the most educated classes. But the plebeian class was also represented. That is kind of the equivalent of the working class, the lower class, you know, by tribunes who served in the Senate, who had great power. A tribune could veto a bill, you know, that the Senate passed. And so everybody within the society had some kind of representation. You know, obviously it was heavily skewed toward the elites, you know, but the people had a lot of power through their tribunes and through political violence, you know, because people, when things went bad, there were a lot of riots in Rome, you know, over matters that they didn't like. If the plebeians felt that they weren't getting their fair share, or that the Senate was tending toward a tyranny or something of that sort, you know, everybody was, all the classes were concerned about going back to being a king. Rome had started off as a kingship, and they didn't even rule over themselves. You know, they were, you know, Rome had sort of been started off as the guests of the Tuscans, and they were lorded over by a different group. But they got rid of those kings and established their first republic. And all of the classes didn't want to go back to that, or at least not for 500 years. So that's a good long stretch. especially compared to democratic Athens. So the founders, looking at that fact, you know, said, well, you know, Republican systems seem to be more stable, and they are more fair to more people in terms of providing representation. But even here, you know, the Roman Republic didn't last forever, and it eventually fell prey to becoming an imperial system ruled by an emperor, which is even worse than a king. You know, a king, at least, is just a mortal, but an emperor is supposed to be divine. And, you know, that happened, you know, well, in a nutshell, it was very hard. The Roman Republic worked well when it was pretty much confined to Italy before it became an empire. And probably the beginning of the end for them was were the Punic Wars, when Rome had to fight this, basically it was the equivalent of a world war in the known world at the time. There were three great Punic Wars that lasted over a period of more than a century between Rome and Carthage, you know, which was a rival growing empire in North Africa. And in fact, the future of Western civilization was on the line, because if Carthage had won, the future of the West would be very different. Our civilization would have been rooted in Asiatic traditions instead of the Greek and Roman European type traditions. Everyone probably knows about the great Carthaginian general Hannibal, you know, who was the one who came closest to destroying the Roman Republic. Seemed unbeatable, but in order to prevail in that war, they had to mobilize their resources to fight this, you know, lengthy, multi-generational world war against the Carthaginian Empire. And by the end of it, the armies of Rome were professionalizing. So they had been, one of the things that was stabilizing and kept the Roman Republic a republic was the fact that most of the Romans didn't live in cities. You know, the people who voted were farmers, small farmers. But these were the very people who had to serve in the armies. And in order to keep the armies in the field, eventually they had professional armies. And so people didn't make their living. The small farmers became soldiers and were kept in the army permanently and ended up making their living there as professional soldiers. And as Rome had all these territories that it conquered in the conquest of winning the Punic Wars, you know, it had to maintain this empire, and it became an imperial system, an imperial system where, you know, a lot of their power and wealth, you know, was based on conquering and taking over the wealth of other countries and opening them up for trade agreements and deals where Roman merchants would predominate, and the farms that used to be farmed by Romans ended up being taken over by the wealthy senators. So senators ended up having these vast tracts of land that were farmed by slaves and not by free Romans anymore. And once you had the people basically militarized and serving in the army, you know, it put the power into the hands of the generals in the end of the day, regardless of what the Roman quote-unquote constitution said and the traditions of Rome said. You know, the fact was that if you were a general and you had you were able to win the plebeians over to your side by bread and circuses, the plebeians living in Rome, you know, you could position yourself to basically set yourself up as a king, what eventually became an emperor, which is why Julius Caesar was assassinated. You know, he was perceived by the Roman Senate quite correctly, you know, as basically a person who was on the verge of making himself a king. In fact, he was the dictator of Rome. The Senate voted him that, and he, in effect, before his death, had deconstructed, you know, what had been the Roman Republic. I mean, it existed only in name, and did continue to exist in name throughout the period of Imperial Rome. But in fact, the Senate was pretty powerless and just a a toy of the emperor's. It was a vestigial remnant of the past to convince the people that they still had some influence and that things had not changed. But in fact, they were being run by one man, by the emperor, and that turned out, the first emperor turned out to be Octavian, who was the nephew of Julius Caesar. And there was one more huge cataclysmic civil war to decide that between Octavian and Mark Antony and Cleopatra. With, again, the future of Western civilization was at stake, because if Mark Antony and Cleopatra had won, the roots of Western, we would probably have been governed out of Alexandria, Egypt, and the roots of our civilization would have been coming out of the East instead of out of the West. Although I've always been sympathetic to Cleopatra, particularly, you know, she had the vision, same kind of vision that Alexander the Great had, which was that the Roman Empire should be a cosmopolitan society, not a collection of conquered people, but that everybody, the notion of Roman citizenship should be extended to everybody. And Octavian did embrace that idea. He basically stole it from Cleopatra and became, when he became the Emperor Augustus, the month August is named after him. And he was the first Roman emperor, and prevailed over, he began this period called Pax Romana, where for about 200 years there were no major wars, a lot of minor ones, but no major serious, you know, world war epic struggles anymore.
That's usually where the problems come, no war for a while.
Yeah, people get bored.
Kind of resembling that these days. We have to take one really quick break here before the top of the hour. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I just ordered up a beer and sat down at the bar when some guy walked in and said, "Who owns this car with the peace sign and the mag wheels and four on the floor?" Well, he looked at me and I damn near died, and I decided that I'd just wait outside. So I laid a dollar on the bar and headed for the door. Just when I thought I'd get out of there with my skin, these five big dudes come. This man has gone as far as tearing Wallace stickers off the bumpers of cars, and he voted for George McGovern for president. Well, he's a friend of them long-haired hippie-type pinko fags. I bet you he's even got a commie flag tacked up on the wall inside of his garage. He's a snake in the grass, I tell you guys. He may look dumb, but that's just a disguise. He's a mastermind in the ways of espionage. They all started looking real.
I need to get a longer cut on that, because then the guy says he doesn't have a garage.
You're bad.
I keep forgetting that part gets cut off. You don't get the whole story. All right, sorry. Back to Cleopatra. I was going to play Walk Like an Egyptian, and then...
Oh, too bad.
That's, yeah, I know. I had it all ready, and then I changed my mind at the last minute.
Well, it's not really that relevant to Cleopatra. But so what lessons did the founders learn from the Roman Republic? Well, first, more than almost anything, they feared the centralization of power, because they correctly saw that, that was the great flaw in the Roman Republic, that, you know, when you, the small farmholders and the small landholders who lived outside of the city of Rome, you know, were a great counterbalance to the Senate becoming, you know, too powerful, and to government becoming too powerful. And they feared the centralization of power both in a particular city or capital, as well as the centralization of that power in the hands of the executive, you know, someone who would be a king or an emperor, you know, because if that person acquired enough power, he could use it to give favors to the lower classes, to the classes, to the poor, and to the plebeians, and basically use that to make civil war or to make a nonviolent overthrow of the republican system, you know, so that the Senate, the legislative part, would become irrelevant. You know, people would give their loyalty to that one man, the man on the white horse, you know, who was able to dispense favors and money and power. And likewise, the centralization of power into the one part of a society like that, like in a city of Rome, would create the basis for creating an imperial system you know, where the hinterlands, everybody else that belonged to that empire would be dominated and possibly, you know, and persecuted by it, exploited by it, you know, so that the people who lived and dominated the bubble that was Rome, you know, everybody else would basically be enslaved to serving its interests. And that was to be avoided. Another big lesson for them was you must control the military. You know, for the military to become independent of the civilian authority, you know, was a great danger to the existence of a free system, a republican system, or a democratic system, any kind of a free system. And that's why the president is commander-in-chief in our system. And we get so upset, you know, whenever generals start speaking out or any military officers start getting extremely political and start speaking out against the commander-in-chief. You know, this is one of the things the founders feared most, that our system would self-destruct. You know, not that we would be conquered from the outside. You know, in the 1700s, you know, we were protected by the Atlantic and Pacific. The idea of a power, we had just defeated Britain. You know, that was one of the greatest military powers in the world at the time, and so we were pretty confident we could defend our own shores from a foreign invaders. The founders had no conception of nuclear weapons and ICBMs and biological weapons, which has changed that part of the calculus in terms of the danger that foreign states pose to us. But they are still right that one of the greatest, perhaps they're still completely right, that the single greatest threat to us is ourselves, is the failure to be a vigilant and educated citizenry who... We're not supposed to trust government. We're supposed to watch government like a hawk, because it's supposed to be the biggest threat to our freedom, that it will get too much power and be able to, and we're not supposed to trust Washington, you know, because that's where our power is concentrated. And the Washington bubble, you know, can become, most Americans, I think, believe it has become, you know, the locus of our elites, and that we've basically got a new imperial system where Washington is the new Rome, and the states of the United States are the conquered empire, that most of our population, the tax policies, the policies that come out of Rome serve the interests of the elites in Washington, not the people who belong to the United States. And that our interests are subordinate to their interests, which, when it's supposed to be the other way around. You know, that's why in the Constitution, we try to, and in the structure of our government, federalism is supposed to be a small f, not a big f. You know, federalism is supposed to be tempered by states' rights. And in the early, in the Constitution, in the original understanding of it, most governance of people's lives was supposed to come from the states. You know, the state governments were closer to people, the closer to their lives. And people had more control over who served in their state government. And they knew the people better who served in their state government. And that was the way the system was supposed to work. Most governments would be coming out of Washington, would be there for national defense and for managing relations between the states. But Washington wasn't supposed to be the main engine driving the way that whole nation is governed the way it is today. And that is what the Civil War was all about. You know, it really, a recent thing, that a statement, an event I found very depressing, was when a man I really respect, Bob Gates, you know, who has served under many administrations, and Republican and Democrat, and has served as Secretary of Defense and the Director of the CIA. So he's one of our elites. He's one of the, supposed to be one of the best and brightest of our elites. But Bob Gates wants to tear down the Confederate statues too, and he wants to not name military bases after Confederate generals, who he describes as traitors.
What?
And in that one statement of Bob Gates, it proves that even Bob Gates, even one of our best and brightest elites, has forgotten American history, doesn't know American history. You know, I'm sure this will be controversial now, and I'll be completely blacklisted in what I'm about to say because it's so politically incorrect. But, you know, the Confederate generals and the soldiers who served in the Confederacy were not traitors to the Constitution. They were not. They had a different understanding of what the Constitution was. You know,
and that's been completely skipped in the, you know, in the current teaching of history.
States' rights, and frankly, and a lot of historians who are intelligent ones, the good ones, who understand the Civil War, and if you read, you know, modern histories, preferably the ones written in the last century, not the ones coming out of universities now. By the last century, I mean the 20th century. God, that makes me feel old, speaking of the last century. The states never would have joined. They never would have joined into a union if they thought they were surrendering their sovereignty. You know, I think it was a better reading of the Constitution that the states thought they had the right to secede under the Constitution and under their historical understanding of how the Constitution was crafted and all the rest. They thought they had the right to secede. And what they thought they were, that one of the chief, that's the chief thing they were fighting for. They were fighting for states' rights, for their sovereignty, for the right to govern themselves by their state governments. And they identified with their states. They felt that they owed their fealty and loyalty to their states first, not to the Union. You know, that's why somebody like a Robert E. Lee, you know, who was really torn between his loyalty to the Union, to the federal government, and his loyalty to his state. But most Americans, certainly in the South, felt that way and thought that way. Not just felt that way, but thought that way, too. You know, that their first loyalty was to their state. And the intellectual basis, you know, for what the North called the rebellion, you know, and what the South has called the war between the states, and now we call it the Civil War, you know, was over a difference between the interpretation of the Constitution, and I personally believe the South had the theory right. You know, their lost cause resulted in the loss. The Constitution, the original Constitution, was in effect destroyed during the Civil War. You know, and what we came out of that with that Civil War was the United States as we think of it today, as a united system, but really it's an imperial system run out of Washington, where the power is centralized in Washington, and where the states' rights were greatly diminished, both after the Civil War and in every decade since, have been cut back and diminished almost to nothing, you know, which is why it's a little surprising, actually, that the left today is getting away with states' rights arguments when it comes to sanctuary cities.
Well, they're also getting away with, you know, no...
It's supposed to have been resolved, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, they're also getting away with no free speech and all sorts of things. We have to take a break here for the news, and we're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. It is Father's Day, June 21st, 2020, if you are just tuning in with us. And we've got everything you need to know about the show and archives and all sorts of things going back like 10 years at wethepeopleradio.us. So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And my name's Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And if you need John Deere equipment, you need ag tractors, mowers, you name it, they've got it up there in stock and ready to go. Also, there are local Honda generator dealers. Go by and see them. They've got lots of inventory on hand. And also steel products, chainsaws, trimmers, you name it. They got a big inventory of steel products. And you can reach them at 226-9226 or get them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
There you have it. And, you know, we forgot to – okay, I'm using the term we loosely. I've roped you into my we.
Yeah, hold on. This hasn't been pre-approved.
They already had a disclaimer at the beginning.
Yeah.
You should listen more closely next time. We the People Radio is now on TV, which I know seems confusing, but it is. Robert films it and takes the celebrations of capitalism out and then posts that for Channel 23.7 on Tuesday nights on the American Uncensored Television Network. So that's kind of fun. And that the information for that is also on the front page of the website. So there you have it.
There you are.
Dr. Pry, back to you.
Yeah, we were talking about the Civil War.
Yeah.
And what the reason for the Civil War was, states' rights. But let's dive into that a little bit deeper, because a lot of people think that the Civil War was all about slavery, and that's why we fought it. And maybe you could clear that up a little bit.
Sure. Before I do, I want congratulations on your TV show.
Now you can watch us goof around.
Well, it would be a welcome break from the kinds of things that we see on TV these days.
We left the house just about Chris Wallace's swan song about the Trump rally, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, man, the guy falls in a hole. It's so frustrating.
I also can't help but comment that during the news break, we've learned that another statue of George Washington has been defaced.
Isn't
by Black
something?
Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And the incident it just brought to mind an incident that happened in World War II during the Blitz, when a play was going on in London. I don't remember the name of the play. The theme, though, was the struggle between tyranny versus freedom. And there was an epic soliloquy being given by one of the actors, and there was supposed to be thunder in the background. But instead of thunder, the exploding of German bombs was actually heard, and the people didn't go to the subways. It was they were so transfixed by what was happening at this, you know, something that was relevant to their real lives. Here they were locked in a life and death struggle with Nazi Germany for freedom, and they just stood in their seats during that play, listening to it, and you know the bombs going off in perfect timing with the play, and here we are, perhaps not in as dramatic a situation, but we are talking about our current struggle for freedom, our attempt to keep our history from being erased, defaced, and rewritten. And even as we discuss these matters, another bomb has gone off with an assault on George Washington. You know, unimaginable to me in the America that I grew up in, but going back to the Civil War.
Yeah, who would have thought George Washington would become unpopular?
I could talk forever about that, and we'll try to avoid talking forever about it so that we can get back to the history of political violence in America. You know, we talked about Greece and Rome, but yes.
But this is one of the underpinnings of the current violence, is this really fundamental misunderstanding of history, which is why they're tearing down statues and things.
So-called best and brightest among conservatives misrepresent the war, the Civil War, as a struggle between good and evil, between slavery and free states, and that's how it's misrepresented. And, you know, that's not true. Now, it's true that, you know, that slavery was it's one of the things that was a fundamental difference between the North and South in terms of the nature of the civilizations, because we were two different civilizations in the same country growing up, you know. But it wasn't just slavery that made us different. There was a difference in the view of the Constitution. Yes, there was a difference in the economic system. slavery and agriculture, not just slavery, but the fact that the South was chiefly an agricultural country, whereas the North was primarily an industrial country.
Right.
And it had its own kind of slavery, by the way. You know, if you look at what the working conditions were, you know, for women and little children and men in the industrial factories of the North, and you compare that lifestyle to what the slaves had, a lot of people would have considered to live as the slaves did in the South to be preferable. You know, actually studies have been done in terms of the lifespans. And, you know, slaves actually had longer lifespans than these northern industrial workers. Also, the idea that the North had a friendly attitude toward the North didn't fight, but to cut to the chase, Lincoln himself said that, you know, his object in fighting the Civil War was to preserve the Union. And also, but what he didn't say, it was also to recreate the United States, or maybe it wasn't his intention to do that. I think it was. But I think it was his intention to recreate the United States in the form of a federalism with the big F that we were talking about, where there would be more power coming out of Washington and the federal government so that the Republican Party, which was a radical party at the time, you know, could start reconstructing and redirecting the society in the direction that they thought was necessary, which wasn't an evil thing at the time. I mean, we needed railroads. We needed canals. We needed, you know, we needed to be able to clean up the cities and have public water systems that worked and a public education system that was better. And so there were a lot of good things that honest, well-intentioned people thought could be better done from Washington. Although, you know, I don't think that ultimately was true, you know, but a lot of people thought that way. Lincoln said that if he could have preserved the Union and freed no slaves, he would have done that. Or if he could have freed some of the slaves and left others in slavery and preserved the Union that way, he would have done that too. Or if he had to liberate all the slaves in order to preserve the Union, he would have done that too. So out of his own mouth, you know, the great liberator admitted that was the case. And certainly it wasn't the motive among the Union soldiers. I mean, only in about 10% of the North was abolitionist. The idea of the working classes in the North didn't want the slaves free. You know, they were afraid that they were going to come up there and take away jobs. The greatest killing of blacks that happened in American history was done in New York City in 1863, shortly after the Battle of Gettysburg. Because that's when, you know, Union losses were so great that Lincoln had to pass the Draft Act, so that we were drafting people into the army. The issue was constitutionally questionable about whether the federal government had the right to do that. But that's another one of those things that sort of went out the door about the expanding power of federalism, and the draft was enforced with bayonets. The New York City draft riots broke out, and I think over 100 blacks were lynched in New York City, you know, by, you know, rioting mobs of workers who were opposed to the draft and didn't want to go into the army to fight to liberate black slaves. So the idea that we've got this enlightened North that's all against slavery, and that's why the Civil War was fought, no, that's not true. It worked out that way. It worked out that way. But that wasn't the intention of the political right. leaders of the North. They were more or less forced into it. You know, I think it was the hand of God, you know, that forced it. And so did Lincoln. You know, in his second inaugural address, he basically says that, you know, about how the the will of God is mysterious and unknowable, but if every drop of blood that has been spilled, you know, by the slaves has to be recompensed by another drop spilled by those, and he didn't just say the South, but all of them, because he, in his second inaugural address, he characterizes the Civil War as a punishment, you know, from God for the sin of slavery. And so I think that's Lincoln's vision that, yes, the fact of the slave system in the South, that was one of the deep historical factors that led to the Civil War. But it wasn't the motive for Washington to decide to invade the southern states and try to force them in. And it wasn't the chief motive either for the southern states to fight that war. The overwhelming majority of the soldiers in the Confederate Army and the Confederate generals, too, were not slave owners. Or many of them, like Lee, didn't believe in slavery. You know, in the end of the war, Lee was actually responsible, you know, because he was such a respected figure. He was the South's only hope. But at his direction, they were recruiting. They didn't draft. They never had a draft, but they were recruiting blacks into the Confederate Army.
Now Lee, because you wore a gray uniform, it's all what color uniform you wore. Or actually, I think if you're just a statue, you get torn down. I'm not sure if anybody even cares who's on or who they're made.
No.
To honor.
It's history.
Yeah, it's history. Time to get rid of it. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and you are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
That's the song that's coming.
Yeah.
Ashley just apprised me the Lenin statue in Seattle apparently is untouched. Huh.
Huh.
Maybe it was just too big to tip over.
They must not have seen it.
There you go. That's it.
Well, I'll bet the Quetzalcoatl statue in Los Angeles is also untouched.
Yeah,
and probably the Che Guevara High School. I think you've got a Che Guevara High School in Northern California somewhere.
Yes.
Not in real Northern California.
It probably also remains untouched.
Well, the sad part is a lot of these statues they're tearing down are people that actually would have supported their cause. They just don't know their history. So if it's a statue, tear it down. It's just a crime. It really is.
Well, their cause though is not freedom.
No.
But that's sort of, I was going to get to that eventually, but maybe skipping ahead. I think what you said is right, that this is unprecedented. Let me just quickly go back to the Civil War, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be meticulous about this so that I'm not criticized later. Who's saying, well, what about the Emancipation Proclamation, right? And, yes, Lincoln passed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 after the Battle of Antietam, which freed... freed the slaves in the slave states, okay, but not in the border states, because it was against all the countries that were in rebellion. That was done as a war expedient. The object was, there was an understanding, slavery is helping the Southern war effort. And so, yes, the 10% of the abolitionists were made happy by that, but the chief reason for doing it was to keep England from intervening in the Civil War on the side of the South. They were very inclined to do it because the cutoff of cotton, which supported England's chief industry, which was the manufacture of cloth and clothing goods, was suffering very badly from the loss of Southern cotton. And so there were a lot of people in England who had wanted them to intervene in the Civil War and let the South go free, and they also considered that to be in their long-term geostrategic interests, that the United States was made weaker by being split in half. But England did have a very strong anti-slavery faction, and the Emancipation Proclamation helped prevent, you know, England's intervention. So there were all kinds of other reasons. I'm sure Lincoln himself, you know, was against slavery, of course, but that wasn't his chief reason for doing any of those things. And in fact, another misunderstanding I think people have about 19th century abolitionism, especially prior to and during the Civil War, is the idea that everybody thought like Frederick Douglass and thought blacks and whites could live together. That wasn't the case, even for a lot of the abolitionists, including Lincoln. They thought a lot of the abolitionist solution was, okay, we'll free the slaves and send them back to Africa, you know, because whites and blacks can't live together. That's why there's a nation in Africa named Liberia, and it had, I think its capital today is still named Monrovia, after our President Monroe, and I think the flag still resembles the American flag, because that experiment was actually going on. They were sending freed slaves back to Africa to live in Liberia, you know, because they didn't envision a cosmopolitan future for us where the races would live together in harmony. Not all abolitionists thought that way, but Lincoln at one point did, and a lot of the northern abolitionists did. So, you know, the North doesn't necessarily have the high ground. The Civil War is a very complicated history, and but what's not complicated is the real valor and genius of Southern soldiers and Southern generals who were fighting. They weren't traitors to the Constitution. Yes, they were traitors to the U.S. government, okay? But is that necessarily a bad thing if you're defending the Constitution? You know, another thing that Americans have forgotten, important lesson from the Civil War, your loyalty is not supposed to be to the U.S. government. It's supposed to be to the Constitution. Now, the U.S. government, of course, I don't want to use the word confuses, all right? You know, obviously, if you're applying for a federal job and you're going to work in the Department of Defense or one of the intelligence agencies, swearing allegiance, you know, to protect the United States and all the rest, that you're going to serve the government, is kind of assumed that, well, that's the same thing as serving the Constitution. But the founders didn't see it that way. And if you're a student of history, you understand that there's a difference between the Constitution and the U.S. government, or at least there can be. You know, our assumption is that the U.S. government is serving the Constitution. But we're supposed to be an educated public, and we're supposed to watch that government like a hawk. Why? Because government is the biggest threat to the Constitution. You know, if it gets too big, it gets too intrusive, it becomes too powerful so that it imposes upon your liberties and the Bill of Rights. That's why we have a Bill of Rights, so you'll know what they are. And if you see your Second Amendment, for example, basically being taken away, you know, maybe that government isn't serving the interests of freedom and the Constitution well anymore. You know, the argument that makes Black Lives Matter so sympathetic to a lot of people, so that we could even say things like, well, we think if George Washington was alive, he'd be supporting the interests of Black Lives Matter. You know, that's because if we take a superficial understanding and believe them, sort of take at face value what the BLM people say, is that, well, we're trying to protect our civil rights because the police are murdering us and we're against this institutional racism and the police are getting too powerful. You know, that's a sympathetic argument. And so we assume that George Washington would support that. And he would if that was all there was to it and if it was true. But I don't think it is true. And, well, maybe I should go, God, I'm skipping past the American history part. Do you want me to? Should I just continue in this vein and sort of cut to the chase?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And then maybe we can open it up to discussion where I can kind of recap and talk about the American past and how what we're experiencing today is different from what one might consider constructive political violence in the past. But, you know, there's a big difference here today because Black Lives Matter, Antifa, they are the face of a totalitarian movement that threatens our freedom, threatens the Constitution, threatens our society. They're not alone, and they're not even the most powerful part of their movement. You know, this is being encouraged and egged on by the Democrats, you know, which are, you know, I've said before on this show that we're not a constitutional republic anymore. Not really. You know, a constitutional republic can't exist when one of the major parties doesn't believe in the Constitution anymore and uses extra-constitutional means all the time and only cares about power. You know, they've abused the Constitution with these false impeachment charges. They've weaponized, done exactly what the founders feared most by weaponizing the intelligence community. You know, one of the most important and powerful parts of our national security apparatus and the Justice Department. You know, the most important, powerful police force, the FBI, in the nation, weaponized those things against the other political parties.
And the media allows all of it.
Right. And they're the other element of it. So you've got these three big elements that make an enormous elephantine totalitarian movement that, frankly, seems almost irresistible. You know, the Democrat Party, the mainstream media, most of the mainstream media, except for a few outposts of freedom like yourself and Fox News and One America News, but all the rest of it, you know, is on the left and is not fair and balanced, but is just an endless propaganda machine for the cause of the left, full of lies and disinformation, supporting, you've got the street soldiers, the modern equivalent, well, our equivalent of the brown shirts. They are themselves the fascists, the communists. There's really no difference between them. They believe that political power comes out of the barrel of a gun, not out of the will of the people.
Right.
You know, they don't believe all people are equal.
No, and it's about silencing your critics.
When you think about it, seeing white people going on their knees, you know, this is not because it's some kind of a racial thing that I find it so abhorrent, but because it's like bending your neck to have your head cut off, and it's disrespecting the principles of equality before the law that have been in the making since ancient Athens, and is at the very foundations of Judeo-Christian civilization, that we are all made by God, and we don't have equal talents, but we have equal rights, and those rights aren't given to us by the state; they are given to us by God and nature. We're born with them. And when you bow and you go on your knees to somebody, you know, you're basically surrendering. You're saying, you're superior to me. You occupy some moral high ground that's better than me. You're a better person than me. You're a better race than me. You're deconstructing Judeo-Christian civilization.
Well, which in and of itself is racism, because if everyone is racist, then no one is. I mean, you can't have... It's just not possible.
We've
got to take a really super quick break, and yet let's not lose that thread, because I'm not and people don't feel good about standing up against that. So tools and information, I think, would help folks at this point. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So oftentimes it happens.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone. Another brick in the wall.
Oh, do it again.
stay another brick in the wall.
Just give that a moment to soak in.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Bragg.
Uh-oh.
Did we lose you?
He's in the cone of silence.
This idea of...
Oh, there he is. He's back.
Going down on the knees and all the rest.
Yes.
You know, not only should it feel dehumanizing to people, but it is, in fact, dehumanizing. It makes you... It lays the foundations for a new Holocaust, okay?
Mm-hmm.
As hard as that may be to believe, people didn't believe and are still puzzled, and we have museums dedicated to how did the Holocaust happen in Germany? And Russia, communist Russia under the Bolsheviks, had it a worse Holocaust. More people were killed for politically incorrect views in the Soviet Union than were killed by the Nazis, you know, during their Holocaust against various minorities, particularly against the Jews. And communist China beats the Soviet Union from its cultural revolution. It can happen when you become a totalitarian or an authoritarian state. In fact, it has to happen. We become a totalitarian, authoritarian state because there's always going to be those stubborn minorities who are unwilling to give up their freedom, to accept that they are inferior, to give up their God-given and natural rights. And totalitarian and authoritarian movements can't tolerate that. And that's why they are willing to use violence and are using violence now. You know, beating up on people who are not like them, attacking Trump supporters, you know, attacking the culture. And that's also a feature of all totalitarian movements. A clear sign of it, and one of the things that sets it apart, as was said at the beginning of the show, from all the other movements that America has experienced in the past. You know, this happened in the Cultural Revolution in China, happened in Russia, happened in Nazi Germany. It happened during the French Revolution, during the worst of the French Revolution, during the Terror. You know, what they want to erase the past and then rewrite the past. They even wrote a new calendar during the French Revolution. You know, the object is to brainwash the masses, the people, to reinvent, to convince people that the past is irredeemable and evil and needs to be rejected so that you can start with a blank slate and the totalitarians will write upon that black slate. BLM and Antifa and the Democrat National Committee want to be able to write upon the blank slate of your mind their vision of a new America, you know, which envisions basically if their agenda is enacted, they can't implement their agenda of economic control to avoid the alleged climate disaster that looms upon us in just 12 years and overcome the deeply embedded problems of institutional racism, which are so profound that even cartoons have to be corrected, and our statues have to be torn down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this can't be done in a liberal, tolerant, cosmopolitan society. It can only be done with totalitarian means. And they will be happy to do it because, to take Barry Goldwater out of context, you know, extremism in the service of quote-unquote liberty is no vice. Goldwater was right, of course, but he was talking about liberty in terms of defending the Constitution and defending the kind of society we are or were in Goldwater's time. You're not remaking us into this Marxist, socialist, atheist, racist, dystopian system that the left has in mind for us, and it will be all those things. How do you convince people that by public policy, by biological race, that there are two biological sexes, is inappropriate, and that the bit more important reality is 26 genders? You know,
yeah.
You can't, you know, just to take that one thing, it's going to take violence, you know, to have people re-educate their children in elementary school to make them to be okay with that. And one has to fight back and stand up for this. And that's what you're doing. That's what I'm doing by trying to speak out. Of course, these people don't. I don't expect one can implement. You know, you can't reason with totalitarian movements. But there's something else I do want to say about this. I think I don't want it misunderstood. But a lot of people feel in their bones that the Black Lives Matter complaint and the Antifa complaint and the complaint of a lot of protesters who don't belong to either of those movements, that the police are out of line, the police have gotten too much power, that the police kind of have a license to kill. They feel in their bones that that's somehow right, that argument is right, and the police power has to be rolled back. And I think that's right, too. Not because BLM and Antifa are correct. You know, they're taking a real problem and distorting it and using it, capitalizing, as it were, to try to turn it toward their totalitarian ends. Believe me, the police power that they will have when it comes to enforcing their value system will be Gestapo-like compared to the modern, and like the KGB. It'll have to be.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, those guys get their hands on the levers of power.
Sure,
right?
It'll have to
for
be.
For all their complaints right now. But to complete this thought, why do I think there is a problem, a structural problem? But it's not a racist problem. I think the problem is actually more profound than that. You know, and maybe it can be understood because we've talked for a long time about the context of history and where we were and what the founders expected. You know, the police have to enforce the laws. And as the state has grown more and more powerful, it has passed more and more laws that get more and more intrusive into our lives, so that we are, as a society, I think the founders would be ashamed of us, and they would find modern American society unrecognizable in terms of what they intended in the Constitution. You have to get a building permit to put a fence on your property, and it can't be of a certain height.
Yeah.
On property that you own yourself. You know, we routinely have to submit to, I'm not saying we shouldn't have traffic tickets and the like, okay? But they've become so commonplace, and they're used for another way of taxation, you know, that it's like the relationship between the American people and the state has become a lot. It's almost a feudal relationship now, you know, so that the police serve as, you know, in the cartoons, the bad guys for the evil prince who lives in the castle. They come down, they grab the peasant and shake him upside down to get the coins out of his pocket. We were never supposed to have an income tax. It didn't have one, you know, until I think it was 1913. The founders didn't want the federal government to be able to have the pig trough of being able to consume to tax people directly, because they feared the government would grow so big it would eat out the substance of the people. I'm not saying the police are bad guys. I think 99% of the police are good guys. Most of them are conservative. But they have been put in the unfortunate position of having to enforce the laws that have been passed by elites at the federal and state level that have become so intrusive.
Yep.
We've been moving for decades toward a soft authoritarian, a soft totalitarian kind of a system. You know, people are defending the idea that suddenly your natural rights and your individual sovereignty is suspended when a police officer stops you and you have to behave like a slave in the presence of a police officer. And I don't think the founders would be okay with that. You know, we've got these professional police departments that are so removed from the people that the idea of proportional force and, you know, for all the politeness one may have when you're writing traffic tickets and arresting people, you know, I think it has gotten out of hand. I think there are too many laws. I think the state and federal governments have gotten too powerful. And I think that's why the police are so unpopular. They're the ones that get the blame.
Right.
But the ones who really deserve the blame are the power elites at the state and federal governments who are putting the law enforcement officers in an impossible position.
Exactly.
Let me tell you a story.
Well, hold on. Hold your thought on that. We've got to take one more quick break before the top of the hour.
Don't lose the story.
But I want to stay on this vein because that's an excellent point that the police...
They don't make the laws. They just carry them out.
They have to enforce these silly laws that politicians are...
Especially out here in California. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
A generation lost in space with no time left to start again. So come on, Jack, be nimble, Jack, be quick. Jack Flash sat on a candlestick, 'cause fire is the devil's only friend. Oh, and as I watched him on the stage, my hands were clenched in fists of rage. Born in hell could break that Satan spell, and as the flames.
This old man and me were at the bar, and we were having us some beers and swapping night on cares, talking politics, blonde and redhead chicks, old dogs and new tricks and habits we ain't kicked. We talked about God's grace and all the hell we raised. And then I heard the old man say, God is great, beer is good, and people are crazy.
There you go.
There you are.
That's the whole deal in a nutshell. But, you know, you were right on when we unceremoniously preempted you. The police don't pass all these crazy laws. And there is also a huge distinction between elected law enforcement and appointed law enforcement. So your city police are operating at the behest of your city council. And your sheriff's department is following an elected official. And usually, in most places, those are really different. Those are really different groups of people, and different attitudes.
Quite right. Well, we don't have a lot of time left.
No.
I'm not sure I have enough time for my anecdote.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I'll try to tell it quickly.
You have like 9 minutes.
All right. You know, oh, maybe it was 15 or 20 years ago. Ruth is my wife. We were in our 40s. My son, Frank, was, I think, 8 years old. And we were on vacation in Virginia Beach. And she was walking her dog. We were together walking her dog on the beach. And a young police officer came up and stopped us. And told her she couldn't walk the dog on the beach. You know, that we had crossed an invisible township line out on the beach into another township that prohibited walking the dog on the beach. And my wife, Ruth, you know, didn't argue with him. She was just...
Uh-oh. What happened?
I don't know. He got cut off.
Oh, no.
Maybe you crossed into an invisible township.
He was on the beach.
The invisible township of silence. Dr. Pry, are you in there? Well, there's sirens outside. Does that mean anything?
Oh,
darn it. We just got to the good part, and he was worried he didn't have enough time. Then we had a technical issue. Maybe we can call him back.
Try to call him back and see if we can get him on another line there.
Catch him before
it died.
Too late.
Could have been the NSA. Could have been the Chinese. There's
a lot of
players out there. You don't know.
But, you know, not having the police, while we have this little... time filler. I was just looking up the thing in Minneapolis. You know.
Yeah, it's not working out well for him up there. They got
Well, he took her away.
Hey, he came back.
Took my son and had to wait.
Dr. Pry?
Let her go.
Okay.
okay.
Oh, but wait, you have to go back. We missed about a minute. You were totally silent there. You crossed into an Invisible Township line, and then you went away.
Yeah, you were. Last we heard, you were walking on the beach.
Okay.
Sorry.
We crossed an Invisible Township line, and then a young police officer showed up to tell us that we were in a new township and you couldn't walk the dog on the beach. He was a 20-something police officer. We were in our 40s. My 8-year-old son was with me, my son Frank. And, you know, my wife, as you women are inclined to do, you didn't hear that, but I'll repeat it for you, decided to pick a polite fight with this officer over whether that law made any sense. Because she thought she should have the right to walk her dog. And wasn't that a silly law? And she did it in a nice way. She wasn't argumentative or bad. But apparently he took offense and decided to handcuff her in front of me and my 8-year-old son and take her away in the patrol car.
Stop it.
And I knew, cow.
And at that moment, you know, I faced a crossroads in my life. And I thought I was torn between, should I let this punk do this and humiliate my wife and me in front of my 8-year-old son? Should I fight him? Or should I, I knew if I did that, I was getting into felony territory. Maybe even get killed by this person. And I knew in a flash, I thought, you know, this is a dilemma that poor black families confronting the police probably face every day. And it probably accounts for a lot of the crime, you know, where officers don't use their judgment, and they don't feel responsible for de-escalating, but are much more interested in exerting their power and control instead of they are in de-escalating and solving problems. Maybe psychologically, American police should take a lesson from Britain's bobbies, you know, who have a much more sedate and are not focused on control and power in the relationships. Anyway, you know, I just had to stand there, you know, and take it. Got in the car, followed the cop to my to his police station, where he held my wife for a couple of hours before he let her go. You know, we wrote a letter of protest later, but I think that's an example. You know, an example of an experience I've had, and I'm sure a lot of Americans have had. And it doesn't have to do anything with racism, but it has to do with passing too many laws and having police who have the wrong attitude in relationship to American citizens who are equal to them. We're equal to them in the eyes of God and in the Constitution. We're supposed to be regarded as citizens to them, and they are citizens too. They're not supposed to be so superior, you know, that there's a little bubble around them when they come into your presence that suddenly your natural rights go away and your dignity as a human being goes away. That happens, I think, a lot in our society. You know, so I think there is a lot of room for reform of the police. But again, I'm not blaming the police chiefly. I'm blaming those idiots that pass laws like the one that make it an arresting offense to walk your dog on a beach in some township. You know, we've got too many laws on the books like that. Now, to the Black Lives Matters, the greatest fault, you know, among our racial minorities, you know, who feel that the system is racist and oppressive of their rights. If they want to know what the real chief reason for all of their problems is, they should look in the mirror. They've got the right to vote. They've lived in Democrat cities like Detroit and Chicago and Washington, D.C., all the places where they feel most oppressed and where the poverty rate is the worst and the crime rate is the worst. They've got the power to vote these people out of office, but they vote Democrat decade after decade. You know, if they really think that their systems are institutionally racist, it's their own fault. You know, if they put Republicans in charge of their cities for 60 years, you know, the Democrats have controlled and taken the black vote for granted. You know, if they gave Republicans a chance in these cities, you know, they basically... The Republicans would do whatever they want. And I have a lot of ideas about, I don't know. Let me see how much time we have. What are some of the other things that could be done? I guess we've got 3 minutes. Here's something. I'll throw out one more idea in the last time, and I want to leave you guys a little opportunity to make a comment. Can you hear me, by the way?
Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
Totally fine.
Okay. All right. Antifa. Here's one. I'd like to see a law. If we have to have all these laws, why doesn't somebody pass this law? You know, that the universities be held responsible for the damage that their students are doing. And the deans and the professors who are teaching these kids that violence is justified against our illegal system, I think they should be personally liable. So that the Korean grocery store owner who's had his shop destroyed by Antifa or by Black Lives Matters, you know, who've been in these courses, you know, who have received, been brainwashed by these guys, they should also be personally liable. So the universities should be institutionally responsible and have to pay for this damage. And the professors themselves, they should be suable, you know, by the victims, you know, of Antifa, their students, their brown shirts that they're sending out in the streets. But there's a lot of things like that that we could do. And those are just a couple of my thoughts about, well, what we can do about the current situation, which is unprecedented. You know, this doesn't fit into the... A lot of the political violence in American history has actually been constructive and made us a better country, although people didn't think so at the time. This isn't an example of it. You know, when you're tearing down statues and trying to erase history, a clear sign of a totalitarian movement. And they are clear, and we've never also had a movement before that is so powerful because it's backed by one of the major political parties and by the mainstream media. You know, this is all the earmarks of a revolutionary totalitarian movement, and we need to stop it. We need to stand up to it and fight back.
Yeah, because this isn't something that ends productively. This is something that ends poorly. As we're seeing, I mean, you're looking at Seattle. That's not becoming a nice, you know, they're not growing vegetables and hanging out, you know, in drum circles.
No, it's,
running around with guns and
it's
didn't
turning
get
into
shot?
Mayhem. Same thing with Minneapolis. I mean, the crime right there.
Can't get
the
rid
murders.
Of law and order. There's
you,
a
you can't.
No, there's and, a reason for that. Well, but, everybody else is a victim at that point.
Yeah,
Dr. Pry, we have. Can you believe? Burned through another 2 hours right here. Even on Father's Day, time goes quickly.
Thank you very, very much. That was you made some excellent points there, and I'm glad we talked about history.
Yep.
Because they're trying to erase it.
Absolutely.
And it is what it is. We need to know it so that we, in a lot of cases, we don't repeat it.
We're going to chat with you more about history and some other things next time we see you. Thanks again. Happy Father's Day, everybody. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.